response.
Is your business struggling to be seen, not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, line starts here.
We slowly, because this was sort of the way Smorgasburg started off and the way we were, we became this incubator for small businesses, not because when we first, like, if you go back and look at interviews that first month, we weren't like, this is an incubator for small businesses. Right. We didn't know what we were. All we knew is we wanted to be the best collection of food in LA on Sundays.
Yo, welcome to another episode of In a Minute with Evan Lovett, coming to you live from the IAM studios in the heart of Los Angeles. And I am here with Zach Brooks, the general manager of Smorgasburg LA, which takes place every week, rain or shine, at The Row, which has a lot of history that we'll be getting into, but is the largest weekly food festival in Los Angeles. I read that it might be the largest anywhere, but isn't Smorgasburg New York weekly?
Yeah. I mean, we start. So okay. Smorgasburg in general
okay,
is the largest weekly food festival that happens in the country.
But LA, you guys got the biggest one here, Smorgasburg.
Well, the weekly, because we're kind of the only one. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's, you know, every single Sunday in downtown LA.
And we'll get into details. But what it is a fantastic, awesome festival. And, you know, Zach has actually been described as, quote, the gatekeeper to a coveted corner of LA's culinary world.
Who said that?
How do you like that?
Who called me that?
What kind of pressure is that, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to paint him as a gatekeeper because he's an awesome guy. He was the founder of Midtown Lunch during the blogging era, one of the most influential New York food blogs, but it got national renown. And that springboarded him into a podcast called Food is the New Rock. So he's accomplished. He knows food and he's here in LA. We're going to talk everything Smorgasburg and food in Los Angeles. Welcome, man.
Thanks for having me, dude.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. First thing, tell us what Smorgasburg is. I've been there. It's fun. It's awesome. But lay it out for anybody who doesn't know.
Yeah. So Smorgasburg is every single Sunday in downtown LA. It's 50 plus food vendors, 20 plus shopping vendors, completely free to get in. We have a massive parking lot, which I'll probably spend.
Largest free parking lot in Los Angeles.
I'll talk about that the entire podcast.
4,000 spaces.
Yeah. That is what sold me on taking this job. I was like, all right, I saw the parking lot. I was like, okay, we can make this work. But yeah, it's every single Sunday. It is, and we are about to celebrate our 10-year anniversary.
10-year anniversary, June 21st, which is also solar, what do they call that? Oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on that? What is it? The days, the winter solar.
Father's Day? Are you looking for It's Father's Day.
Oh my God.
I'm also Father's Day.
It is Father's Day?
It is, yeah.
Why is Father's Day so late this year?
We started on Father's Day 2016.
I got to look this up, by the way. Hold on. They call it the summer solstice. How do we not know? Nobody in here knew summer solstice, guys. Come on. We should be ashamed. No. So also summer solstice. But go to the row. It's free. Tell us what it is. I'll tell you what it is from my perspective. There's like 60, 70 food vendors, right? And it's been the incubator for some big dogs. I love micheladas, tacos 1986, Broad Street Oysters. I want to say Mitty's Tacos, right?
Mitty's Tacos started at Smorgasburg. I got a great story about Armin over at Mini Kebab.
He's a dope guy.
I remember the day I met him and his family.
Really?
Yeah. So every vendor who's at Smorgasburg applies. You have to fill out an application. And I remember the day the Mini Kebab application came in. And Mini Kebab at the time, I mean, this was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it was known among, like, if you lived in Glendale, yes, if you followed Jonathan Gold, like, you knew who Mini Kebab was, but not what Armin had just started doing his thing. And for people who don't, I mean, at this point,
Armin Matarossian,
you know, he's Eat Bearded on Instagram.
Oh, right.
He was starting to become like an Instagram influencer, and he was basically dragging his parents' restaurant into the social media age.
Yeah. Very traditional Armenian culture. It's right there on Vine in Glendale, about a block from my son's school. And it used to be a former, or I think it still is, the back of an auto mechanic. And that it kind of developed in, I want to say, the 1970s. His dad took it over and became, as you said, Jonathan Gold. I want to say, and called,
dude,
it the best
the original, Armenian, you know how kebabs, you know, in LA. You know how you know someone knows the real mini kebab?
Huh.
If they've actually had a mini kebab. Because the mini kebab was, it was a, like, one little piece of kubade wrapped in their bread with a little bit of onions. And they sold them for, by the time I found out about it, they were selling them for $2. But I think at one time they sold them for like $1 each. And they would make these trays of mini, like if you had a party, you would get a tray of mini kebabs. And it was almost like a taco.
Yeah.
So when they applied to Smorgasburg, I like excitedly like met with them.
Yeah.
And I got to meet Armin, his family, and they were like, hey, you know, answer all their questions about Smorgasburg. And the way they were thinking about it was they wanted to come to Smorgasburg and sell mini kebabs like tacos. And we had like a super honest conversation, because that's kind of, that's the process. Like when someone applies to Smorgasburg, we have a really honest conversation about like what they're looking to get out of it, you know, like how much food they need or want to sell. Like, cause we don't want people to come in with the wrong expectations.
Right.
We really care about every food vendor at Smorgasburg. We want
them to be
successful.
That's why it's so successful. And that's why it's jumpstarted.
And
a
so
lot
we had
of,
this
like,
huge conversation.
Spots.
And then a month or two later, he came back with the idea for Midi's Tacos.
Man.
Like that conversation morphed into Midi's Tacos, which then launched at Smorgasburg a couple months later.
Shout out Midi's Tacos, which is really cool.
Proud of.
I mean, honestly, like that's... I hate that word fusion, but it's, you know, it's tacos, but like Middle Eastern flavors
that
his family's been doing for 50 plus years.
Everything's fusion.
Yeah.
Like everything is fusion.
Right.
Nothing is completely indigenous to one place. Like everything is fusion in the sense that like throughout history, you know, it's just about time, you know, food moves around, people move around, cultures move around. Like, and so what seems like fusion today, 50 years from now, will just be called LA food. I mean, even now we call it LA food. Like that's, you know, that's the beauty of this incredible city.
Can I take a little sidebar here? Since you said LA food, I want to bring up something. This doesn't have to do with Smorgasburg, but I'm going to ask you all kinds of food questions because you are that guy that knows and has done homework and has eaten anywhere. I've been formulating this for a while, and I'm going to do an LA in a Minute episode on this because I want to kind of like introduce the concept, if it hasn't been, of LA Mexican food. Now, okay, what? It's fucking Mexican food's all over LA, of course, all different types, regions, all this stuff. But when I say LA Mexican food, I mean a Casa Vega, El Coyote, El Cholo, the places that sometimes get used as punching bags.
Can I create real controversy?
Yeah.
Nothing you've said so far. I mean, this all sounds completely normal.
But
as someone who lives down the street from Tito's Tacos, do we want to get really controversial about this?
Oh, no. Okay. But here's what I'm saying. These places are punching bags because, oh, the food's no. Yes, you get a number 3 combo with 2 crunchy tacos and an enchilada and rice and beans. And no, that's not, you know, from the Yucatan. It's not authentic, but it's something that I believe is an LA export to the world, the Americanized Mexican food. And you know what? It's damn delicious. And I think it should be celebrated. Again, it's different than going to the taco truck. Like, obviously, you want some like carne asada tacos, like El Pastor off the Trompo. But I think that LA Mexican food should be its own like genre, if not subgenre. What do you think about
that? I mean, I'm a middle-aged white guy. You're preaching to the converted, dude. Like, I don't think I'm the one who's going to bestow the, you know, but yeah, of course. I mean, and I think, listen, to be honest, I think that a lot of people do celebrate it. And I think it is starting to be seen that way and get it. So, you know,
but it needs
have
to not be.
It's never not. Listen, people still, you know, people still shit on Americanized Chinese food.
Okay.
You know, like
okay.
Whether it's Panda Express or and then Italian food went through the same thing in the
80s. Yes.
Like
yes.
Italian food used to be seen as like when French food was considered the like, you know, that was the gold standard of quality food. Italian food was seen as peasant food. It was seen, and then certainly with like Chef Boyardee and all this stuff was all seen as, and so I think food goes through these phases where people will, you know, shit on Americanized Italian American food. And now Italian American food is like, kind of the vault. That's one of the most popular,
Evan Funky, like, man.
Fine dining foods in, you know.
Evan Funky knows it, man.
I mean, I think he would say that he's doing specific regional Italian food. But if you want to talk about like Carbone in New York or, you know, and now in Vegas or even like some of the stuff on Dear John's menu, you know, in Culver City, like, you know, Italian American food has become this thing that people celebrate, whether, you know, chicken parm and, you know, stuff like that. And people will spend an insane amount of money on spaghetti and red sauce now. And so I think, listen, I think Mexican American food is starting to get its due. I think as time goes on, you know, it'll be more and more.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm still fighting for my subgenre and for the classic American Mexican places not to be hated on. But this is not about what I think. It's about what you think, and it's about celebrating Smorgasburg and 10 years. Take us back to the beginning. How did Smorgasburg LA start? I know, obviously, Smorgasburg in Williamsburg, right?
Yep.
Tell me when you got involved. Tell me that transition, the origin of Smorgasburg.
Yeah, so that was the original Smorgasburg launched a little over 15 years ago in Williamsburg. That's where the name comes from, Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a smorgasbord in Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And so I lived in New York like over 20 years at this point. It's been forever.
Yeah.
But I lived in New York a long time ago. I didn't work at Smorgasburg.
Where were you born?
I knew the guys. I was actually born in Miami.
Whoa.
I grew up in Miami.
Did not know
different,
that.
Completely
grew up
different
through
story.
High school? Through
yeah,
high school?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Born and raised.
What the hell was that? Born like, stop raised. For a second. Yeah, I've never known a Miami native.
I got to be honest. I feel like wow, LA, Miami. Why I felt, you know, and at this point, I've now lived in LA longer than I lived in Miami.
Yeah.
And like four times as long as I lived in New York. So I've lived here longer than any place I've ever lived.
Yeah.
But I think the reason why I felt so at home in LA is because it is such a combo of Miami and New York. Ooh. Like, it's got like the urban sprawl, the traffic, none of that bothers me because I grew up with that.
Okay.
You know, everyone speaking Spanish, grew up with that, like, you know, all of it.
Yeah.
Now culturally it's completely different.
Correct.
Which is something I learned when I moved here and got made fun of by a lot of Mexicans and Mexican Americans that I worked with.
Why? Because you had more Cuban influence
or something?
Because
the way I spoke Spanish at the time was...
really?
You know, when I first moved here, I was just like, hey, ¿qué pasa, chico? Like, and people were like, no, that nobody talks like that here.
Interesting.
And I was like, what do you mean? Okay. You know, the curse words I used were completely different. You know, and then I learned things like, you know, buen provecho, of course, was an incredibly important thing I learned as a food lover. Like, no one ever said that in Miami.
But hold on. What was your origin as far as like loving food or getting into in Miami back then?
Food,
was there a
I
food
mean, so
scene?
Honestly,
correct?
Like, you know? It was my parents got separated when I was young.
Yeah.
And so, but my dad would come and pick us up two nights a week and take us out to dinner every Tuesday and Thursday night.
Yeah.
And then on Saturdays, on the weekends, we'd go out and eat. And so we always ate out. And so it was like, you know, mall food courts, which is where I developed my love of Panda Express.
Sweet.
But it was also like Thai food restaurants. My dad was in the army.
Oh, wow.
So he spent time in Korea. And so he loved Korean food. Took me to my first Korean restaurant.
Okay. Is there a big Korean culture down there?
There isn't, actually. There was one Korean restaurant in downtown LA. And I remember eating there with my dad. He took me in high
school. Downtown Miami.
Downtown Miami, sorry. It was in downtown Miami. He took me in high school. And I remember first time I ate kimchi. It's so embarrassing. He was like, here. He's like, try this. And I was like, what is it? And he was like, it's one of the most disgusting things you've ever eaten.
Yeah.
And I said, well, then why would I want to eat it? And he's like, because it's so... He's like, the more you eat it, the more you grow to love it. And I was like, okay. And I took a bite and I was like, whoa, I really didn't have, even though it has like similar things to like sauerkraut or things that I had as a high school kid who had never eaten anything like that.
Yeah.
I was completely like, but then, you know, 5 minutes later, I was like, I need another bite of that.
Yes.
Like, and you know, whatever. And the other crazy thing was, the thing that this restaurant was known for was these noodles in black bean sauce, which was delicious and had little chunks of onion, chunks of meat. And so that was my first Korean food. And then when I moved to New York and was, exploring Koreatown and, you know, learning about obviously like Korean barbecue and bibimbap and all the like entry level white people Korean food,
yeah.
right? I was like, I never saw that. It was a while before I saw that noodles and black bean sauce thing again. And it was a number of years before I ate at my first Korean Chinese food restaurant.
Yeah.
And had that dish, which is a staple, jajangmyeon, which is a staple of Korean Chinese food.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh shit, I was like, the first Korean food restaurant my dad took me to in high school was actually a Korean Chinese food restaurant.
That's an interesting
if it was run by a Chinese people who were from Korea,
yeah,
or Korean people who just thought that Chinese food would be a better entry point, yeah, for people in Miami who'd never, yeah. But yeah, I have real vivid memories. So I grew up eating meals like that with my dad, that, yeah, really, you know, like just sort of turned me into a person that just always cared about eating.
And then you went to New York for school?
Yeah, so, or no, I actually lived in Boston. I went to Boston for school, damn, lived okay. there for 10 years. That's where I started my career in radio.
Dude, with all these numbers, I know, think, see, are you like 94?
I'm so old, dude.
No, you look great. Don't even tell.
Thanks, yeah. buddy. Thanks.
Go on.
So yeah, and then, you know, in Boston, I was the guy at work. I worked for a radio station in Boston called WFNX, okay. which is kind of like the K-Rock of Boston. You know, first radio station in the country to play Nirvana. Wait, that's not going to help me not sound old. But but yeah, so I was the one who was always like, where are we going to lunch, guys? Where are we going to lunch? And then when I moved to New York, and actually between Boston and New York, I lived in L.A. for a couple of years.
There you go.
And worked for Indy 103. Those who know, know.
But what era was this?
This was 2004.
Okay, early 2000s.
And Indy 103, an amazing, amazing.
Was that your first trip to L.A., first time in L.A.?
I came here in high school for just a trip, did the whole, I did the whole Price is Right,
To go to Hollywood.
Walked the Venice Pier.
Did you do Hollywood?
Saw Arnold Schwarzenegger get his star on the Hollywood Walk
great
of Fame
one.
just by accident.
Nah,
like, I was
great.
Just walking around yeah. and that was happening.
You're like, I'm going to live here. Someday.
Yeah. And then I lived here. I lived here for 2 years, worked at Indy 103, best radio job I ever had. But then my wife got a great job in New mm-hmm. York and, you know, we moved to New York for a few years.
Real quick though, yes. 2 years in LA, what were your thoughts? How did you acclimate?
I mean, it's tough because I was insanely poor. And so my splurge meals were like Mario's Peruvian. Mm. Like I was like, yeah, that was, you know, and this was 2004. And like, I don't think Jonathan Gold was not on my radar at the time.
Wow. Okay.
And food was, you know, there were certain things I loved, but that wasn't the year I spent here was not, it wasn't a huge, I spent a lot of time in Thai town.
Yeah.
Went to see Thai Elvis a lot, for those who remember that dude. But yeah, my food, the real food when I became a serious food person was when I lived in New York. And that was
Wait, what neighborhood did you live in LA?
In LA, I lived on Franklin. I lived on Franklin. Right and there. So like, I guess sort of what people would call East Hollywood.
Yeah, we call it East Hollywood. But that could be Hollywood proper too, though.
Yeah, I mean, it was like on the border. I like to think I lived in Los Feliz at the time, you know. And
But still cool, though. It's still, okay.
So it was great. I mean, it was down the street from, you know, back when when Birds was a thing on Franklin.
A lot of police?
No, it was like a little like hipster like. They did a really good rotisserie chicken, onion rings on a pole.
I think that was a Michael Connelly novel. Okay, go on.
Yeah. Then I moved to New York and I worked at Sirius Satellite Radio. And that's when I, you know, actually was making a living and my wife was making a really good living. And we started eating out at nice restaurants. And then I was... I started Midtown Lunch because it was sort of 2006, prime blogging time. Yeah, and I was like, man, I'm eating all these great lunches in Midtown because Midtown at the time, or always, has been seen as sort of a food wasteland.
Yeah.
And so, but if you really like look close, there are all these amazing, amazing places to eat lunch. If you were just willing to walk a couple extra blocks or down a weird like elevator shaft, like hallway,
right.
You could find like some incredible food. Most Midtown office workers were just eating at the like salad bar, like build your own salad bar, turkey sandwich and avocado, like sort of, you know, what I consider to be like not great, like boring
would
lunches.
I be getting on my trade shows to New York at the time at the, in the Marriott, staying in the Marriott. But yeah, go on.
And, right. And street food. Like yeah. Street food was huge. So like street, you know, we were at the, you know, I wrote a lot about like, you know, halal food, street meat, you know, was there during the prime years of like the 53rd and 6th Avenue street meat guys who then grew into the halal guys
wow.
chain.
Okay.
I was there for, you know, because they had a lot of imitators and I wrote a lot about that stuff. And then food trucks, like the beginning of the sort of gourmet food truck era. So I wrote a lot about that in the 5 years I was in New York.
Did that happen as rapidly out there as it did here?
Yeah, like, and it was actually happening. It was happening, but it's interesting because, you know, it at the time, you know, food trucks in New York were controlled by like Mr. Softy trucks. Like Mr. Softy trucks have always been in New York.
Yeah.
You know, and then the street food trucks and it was kind of like there was a sort of a mafia thing that went on in New York that really beat wow. back a lot of the gourmet food trucks
yeah.
From parking in certain neighborhoods.
Of course.
And it was a thing that was, you know, it was kind of this this thing where street vending, it, you know, wasn't fully legal, but it wasn't fully illegal. And the city didn't want to shut it down, but obviously, you know, it didn't let it run rampant. And it was kind of controlled by the reason it didn't grow was because of the street food mafia. But I remember actually, interestingly, during that time, Roy Choi visited Midtown with the Kogi truck.
Yeah.
And I remember it being a huge deal because I had heard about Kogi out in LA and I basically like freaked out on the blog and was like, this is huge. Like, and I remember going down the day he popped up in Midtown and I met him for the first time.
Yeah.
And he had a line of like,
how long was that line?
Oh my God. It was insane.
And he still talks about it.
You know, and we've now since become really good friends. Yeah. And we always
talk
about
that. He's a friend of the show as well. Shout out Roy Choi.
Yeah. We talk about that first time we met and what a huge deal it was. But yeah, it all happened kind of around the same time.
I think we still got to keep amplifying Roy Choi's legacy because I've sort of seen it. There was a time when, and he's Los Angeles royalty and honestly food world royalty. But I don't want him to fall between the cracks. So it's always worth
so first of
propping
all,
up.
And, I don't think there's any chance that's going to happen. Okay, I honestly feel that way.
You got to talk about any chance.
And the thing about him that I always really thought was super interesting yeah. is Kogi, you know, Kogi came up at the time when gourmet food trucks were a thing. And so he constantly gets referred to as the father of the gourmet food truck,
yeah.
which I actually think is bullshit. Like, I think gourmet food trucks, you know, they're, I don't know. I was never, I wrote about it a lot in Midtown
yeah.
and was, you know, but I think very quickly people realize that it's a terrible way to run a business. And actually Smorgasburg is not food trucks. A lot of people refer to us as a food truck festival, yeah. but when you show up, the majority of our vendors are actually vend from tents
yeah.
and that's by
Big
design.
Time.
A few of our vendors have trucks, but the trucks we do have are insanely unique. They don't look like other food trucks. They're
right.
just a very unique, like, you know, one of them, you know, Man-Eating Plant is serves out of a converted school bus,
it's badass,
you know? And so,
yeah.
because for us, you know, we feel like food trucks is a different business. It's a very hard business model to do food out of a food truck. And traditionally, food trucks, especially in LA,
yeah.
were taco trucks. And taco trucks is a decent business to run out of a food truck, whether, you know, at a time they used to be called like roach coaches and
course,
like, you know,
that
which
the,
is,
the
you know, really
beginning.
Derogative. But the reality is that as an entry level, you know, immigrants as an entry level job for immigrants serving food in immigrants' community where they need and want that food
yeah.
or late at night. When there is a need for food because most restaurants in LA don't stay open
Shit.
That late. And so taco trucks have become our late night. And now that's moved to the street, right? There's a lot more street taco stands than food. But at the time that Kogi launched, more late night taco stands were serving out of trucks.
Right.
And what made Roy a genius, and why Kogi was so successful is not because Roy was a gourmet chef. He is not a gourmet. Like, and he is a fucking great chef.
Yeah.
And he can make gourmet food. And he, but what was so genius about Kogi was it took the taco truck. It's a taco truck. It's tacos. It's quesadillas. But it's with his salsas. It's with his marinades. Right. It's with his crossover Korean LA upbringing. So he wasn't trying to shoehorn some like, you know, BS like gourmet concept into a food truck where it has no business really being.
Yeah.
Right. He was taking the taco truck and and creating this new thing that could only happen in LA, that came from LA and is distinctly LA.
Yeah.
And it's why it's lasted so long. Whereas I think a lot of the gourmet food trucks from that time have all come and gone.
And it's the same mechanics that both the consumer and, you know, from a business perspective, so, are already used to, that already established. Know, yeah.
And the real genius for him is that he showed the beauty of LA because Roy is Korean American, but grew up eating tacos, grew up in a community where he went to school with tons of Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, Filipino, like, and he took all of that, his upbringing, and poured it into this beautiful food that couldn't be, you would call it fusion at the time.
Yeah.
But given time, you're going to look at that food and be like, no, this is food that, this is LA food. It is LA food that, you know, undeniable.
This book, actually, Roy's first book, L.A. Sun, goes into right what you were talking about, where this made me understand, you know, I was a Kogi fan, Roy Choi fan, whatever. But reading this, it's autobiographical. It's not, it's a cookbook, even though it is part cookbook.
It's autobiography. And I'm not, you read like, that book and it's like, it is his story. The story is incredible.
To this day, the best weaving of a narrative about the city, where you feel the heart, the soul, the culture with his story, his autobiographical story, and all of that combining is why this food was created. And to your point, that's what you taste. That's what you're eating. And it's not just this great, awesome food that, like you said, 20 plus years later, people are still lining up for, but it is a taste of the city. And it's representative. I think that that's something special. So again, shout out Roy Choi, like absolutely dope. Good way to set that up. Unplanned. And real quick, we got a break for a sponsor right now. We have a new sponsor this episode. It is LA Rises Rebuild Hub. There's still people all in LA from the fires of 2025 that are rebuilding or that are just starting to rebuild. And if you are one of those, go to the resources at the Rebuild Hub. It's larises.org/rebuild. We're going to put that on the screen, but what it is, it's vendors, builders. These are all vetted, credible people, and it gives you options and resources. So it's free to go to the site to check out the vendors, the builders, all that kind of stuff. larises.org/rebuild. And again, people are still recovering from the fires. They go to Altadena, go to Palisades, Malibu. You still see it. There is some work being done, which is awesome. But a lot of people are just getting started. So larises.org/rebuild. Now, talking about rebuilding or just building from the beginning, what were the early days of Smorgasburg in New York like? And then we're going to get to L.A.
So I never worked for Smorgasburg in New York. I knew the guys just from, because it actually grew out of this blog called Brownstoner that was around the same time as Midtown Lunch was.
Okay.
So we kind of knew of each other. And then when I moved to L.A., the Smorgasburg
guys.
Did
you ever go, though?
In New York?
Yeah.
So we didn't like, I went to the, so Smorgasburg grew out of the Brooklyn Flea, which was this hipster flea market in Fort Greene.
Okay.
And I went to the very first flea market, the very first Brooklyn Flea that happened in Fort Greene. Wow. I went to that.
Okay.
But then shortly after that, I moved to LA. And the Brooklyn Flea had a little bit of food.
Yeah.
The food became so popular that when they got approached to open their second market, they were like on the Williamsburg waterfront. They were like, why don't we spin off the food, create a completely different all food event called Smorgasburg.
Right.
And so that launched when I was living here in LA.
Yeah.
And so I kind of knew those guys. And every time they'd visit LA, you know, they'd call me up. I'd take them on a taco.
Hold on, your second tour duty in LA, where were you living?
It was my sister. So second tour, Culver City. We moved to Culver City.
You were early Culver City.
We had a kid. We had a, we had our first kid in New York, moved here when he was one.
Okay.
And so so we moved there for the school. Shout out Culver City Schools.
Okay.
We were very lucky.
Dang, you guys see that evolution. Okay,
yeah.
Go on.
And so so every time the Smorgasburg guys would come out to LA, I would take them on a taco crawl. We'd go to Grand Central Market, like, you know, whatever. And I don't know, we were having lunch one day at Grand Central Market and they were like, "Hey, so we're thinking of bringing Smorgasburg to LA."
Wow.
And I've told this story a lot, but
Eric Demby and Jonathan Butler.
So Eric and Jonathan, we were eating at Grand Central Market. They're like, "Hey, we're going to bring Smorgasburg to LA." And I blurted out, because this is the way I am, that's a terrible idea. And they were like, "Oh, we were going to hire you to curate the food." And I was like, "Oh, well, I mean, I don't want to talk myself out of a job." I mean, at the time I was podcasting. I was freelance food writing. And, at the time, you know, you didn't make a lot of money doing those things.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, well, I don't want to talk myself out of a job." And they were like, okay, but why do you think it's such a bad idea?" And I was like, "Listen," I was like, "LA's not New York. And downtown's not Brooklyn. And if you think you're going to like drop some giant New York market into the middle of LA and just be like, 'You're welcome, Los Angeles.'"
Yeah.
And like tens of thousands of people are going to like wander over from their brownstones. Like that's not, you know. And then they showed me the produce market at the Row.
Good understanding. And I want to stop and pause and appreciate that, because one of my peeves that's been developing more since I've been doing LA Minute is people, not transplants, because transplants built this city, but people come in and say, "Why isn't LA like this city? LA needs to be more like this city." And I'm like, no, LA is such its own entity that kind of annoys me. So I appreciate you at least recognizing that, saying that, and being like, "Listen, it's not that." I think the exact quote I have from you is, "LA is not New York, downtown is not Brooklyn, and if you expect 20,000 people to wander in off the street, you don't understand how LA works." And I love that quote. But once they showed you the produce market, tell us why you think this could work.
I mean, listen, if you've ever been there, and I know you had, you did a video on it.
Like, Alameda Produce Market, by the way, which is still an active produce market.
Yeah, you stand in that market and it's just, I don't know, empty, even empty.
Yeah.
You stand in there and you feel the history. I mean, those buildings have been, the market's been there 100 years.
Yep.
It's the hub of LA produce. Like every restaurant in the city has been to that produce market at least once.
There's an astounding stat. I don't know if this is going to sound impressive, but if you think about it, it is. 1% of all produce in America goes through that market.
That's crazy.
That's pretty significant for one market. And it is big. It is a large.
It's huge.
But 1% of every fruit and vegetable in the entire country goes.
It's crazy.
So it's pretty fantastic. Yeah. So just awe-inspiring size alone.
And so to stand in there, you feel the history. And then you realize, okay, this isn't like some developer fueled like thing.
It's not like downtown Culver City.
And listen, we are a part of the Row, which is a giant development, right? And it can be. And I know a lot of people have seen it that way, and it looks that way, but it also,
it has preserved
this element of history, right? And that's what I loved about this opportunity was that the produce market's open Monday through Saturday.
Yeah.
The first thought I had was, wait, we're not are we closing? Like, are you bringing in Smorgasburg because you want to get rid of this produce market? And of course, they laughed in our faces, like nothing's going to close this produce market. It is a hub of, I mean, it's a massive thing that nothing could, no amount of chain restaurants and like apartment could replace like
Correct.
What, you know, I mean, so many people visit this produce market, but they're closed on Sundays.
Yeah.
So there's this opportunity to take that space on a Sunday and do something cool with it that we can't be open 7 days a week. That's not our model is to be open one day a week, 2 days a week, like we do in other cities. And so together we make each other more sustainable, and it's a beautiful thing. And I love that about it. And then of course they showed us the parking garage, and I was like, all right. I was like, yeah, this is, you know, if we build the LA version of Smorgasburg, then you know, you can have something. And that's what we set out to do. Like, and LA was the first, you know, Smorgasburg had kind of done a few things in other cities, yeah. you know, like one-offs and little pop-ups. But LA was the first one, you know, 10 years ago that's lasted as long as it has. But now we've taken the same model to Atlanta and Miami, where we've now launched like sort of the Miami version
yeah.
of what's more, you know, Smorgasburg is, an Atlanta version. And so you can go to those markets and it's not like you're visiting a chain. You're visiting like that city's version
of
the thing.
And
that model started here. And we had a few things from New York, you know, like that came, but most of the vendors, you know, were small businesses, all from LA, up and coming. And then, you know, as you mentioned at the top of the show, we've just had just a murderer's row.
I forgot to mention Wanderlust.
Of restaurants. Oh, well, there's, I mean,
yeah, another big one, though.
We could talk. I mean, that's the thing.
Did I say Evil Cooks? Did I mention Evil
Cooks? In 10 years, I mean, the names of vendors who started at Smorgasburg and then graduate, you know, we call it graduate to open brick and mortar restaurants. It's wild. I like couldn't, and I mean, yeah, I mean, I couldn't be more proud. It is like, I mean, 10 years, it's wild.
What kind of commitment did you get when they first sat down with you, when you first signed off, saw the parking? And by the way, you're probably the only person I know who gets excited as I do over massive parking lots in LA. I mean, to the point where I just got to drop this. Number one biggest parking lot in the United States is the new Conrack facility, LAX's new car rental facility.
So we just got bumped down? You're saying we got bumped down?
It's not free. That's not free. Which is even bigger than Dodger Stadium's parking lot. We're talking 19,000 spaces, 17,000 spaces. But for
Did I mention our parking garage is free for 2 hours?
So this
did
is
I
what
mention
I'm saying.
That?
Anywhere I go to cover anything in Los Angeles, throughout the county, I'm like, what's the parking situation? And we all know this. This is driving culture. I know that we're, you know, really adopting public transit, Ride the D, all that kind of stuff. But this is still a driving culture and parking is the bane of my existence. You know, I went down to love Venice, but dude, talking Murderer's Road, that's the like feels like you're, it's tough situation to get parking in a lot of the communities in LA. So 4,000 free spaces for a big market is a big deal. And I don't want to put too much emphasis on that, but it's important because you're having 10,000, 12,000 people there. How did you have that vision? What was the vision from everybody when you guys first started? How long are you like, we're going to give this a 1 year run, 2 year run? Like, what did that look like? All the elements were in play, but
I mean, listen, I think it's easy to look back now. I don't even know. Like, honestly, like there is no question that we knew it was going to take time. I mean, we opened the first week and had 10,000 people, even though it was over 100 degrees and vendors. I mean, it was miserable, but people still came out because, again, being a New York thing, and I think out of town restaurants come and they open here and they experience that thing.
Yeah.
People get incredibly excited to have this thing that they kind of know or have heard about. Or if you have a lot of New York expats, which LA does, people are going to come out once. But anybody who's worth anybody who knows anything about the restaurant industry knows that getting people to come out once is not the hard thing.
Right.
It's getting people to come over and over again. It's serving food that's worth coming back over and over again. And so, in the end, we really focused on that. And, you know, week two, we had half as many people. Week three, we had even less.
Shit.
2 months in, we were struggling just like most restaurateurs will tell you talk to them from a business standpoint, you need to have at least a year of runway to build up your customer base so that you can get the press and get the accolades and people know you're there. It's
right.
So hard. You know, people think it's easy, like, oh, you go viral on social media and then a bunch of people show up for like a week.
Yeah.
But what about a month later? Like, what about 6 months later? Like, and there's a difference between things that people just, you know, and so when we first opened, it was the peak of like Instagram food.
Right.
And Smorgasburg was at the center of it. You know, in New York, we were, you know, ramen burgers and raindrop cakes and rainbow grilled cheeses, right? And listen, that was a huge part of our genesis, right? Of
right.
what Smorgasburg, and even when LA first launched, we had a certain amount of that. Like Ramen Burger was at Smorgasburg LA, and we're still proud of that. But we also understood that we could have a few of those things, but you needed more of like the mini kebabs and then if someone like Mini Kebab could do something that could pop on Instagram in the same way, like a Mideast Tacos, where it pops on Instagram, but at its core, it's quality food with an amazing story and a history and family history. And that was our sweet spot. Like, we were looking for, those are the kind of vendors we were looking for, because we knew that it was the kind of stuff people would come back for over and over and over again. And to be in every single Sunday market in downtown LA, we needed that. And so it was not easy. Like, it was not easy. Those first year or two, we had a ton of vendors leave, including the, a lot of the more Instagrammable stuff, a lot of the, you know, and people, you know, but we slowly, because this was sort of the way Smorgasburg started off and the way we were, we became this incubator for small businesses. Not because when we first, like, if you go back and look at interviews that first month, we weren't like, this is an incubator for small businesses. Right. We didn't know what we were. All we knew is we wanted to be the best collection of food in LA on Sundays.
Your quote was, my dream is to have a lineup that Jonathan Gold would love. I also wanted stuff that tourists would love, people on Instagram would love, and second generation Chinese kids from the San Gabriel Valley who know what good food is.
Because in the end, that's what, if you're driving to Smorgasburg from every neighborhood in the city, we are not a farmer's market. Farmer's markets are incredible.
Yeah.
They're a vital part of the city. They're neighborhood markets. We're not a neighborhood market. We need to be something that's worth driving across the city. And we are something. That's why we've been around for 10 years. We're something that is worth driving across the city for. And because of that, it needs to be, you know, and so we became this place where businesses would start to build their name up, businesses that are worth driving across the city for, but, you know, would come, and it was a way for them to start their businesses without having to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into a brick and mortar, see if they had what it took. And the vendors with the longest lines, the ones that were the most successful, they very quick, you know, graduated to opening brick and mortars and are now some of the most successful restaurants in the city.
And was that the big, let's call it, testimonial for you guys in getting new vendors? But when other vendors are leaving, again, what, I guess, what's the point where you're like, this is working? Like, this is something right now. What do you, did you have that moment, or was it just gradually?
Like Smorgasburg itself?
Yeah, Smorgasburg LA.
I still don't feel that way. I mean, it's so hard. Any restaurant, listen, I see us more like a restaurant that's open one day a week than an event or a festival. Like, cause we don't charge tickets.
Right.
You don't have to pay to get in. And we're open every single Sunday. So it isn't, while it is about getting people to drive across and tourists and bringing your family, when you have family in from out of town and coming for that one special day, it's also about trying to get people to come back as much as possible, because, you know, and so it's hard. Like, it is, everyone will tell you in the restaurant business that food, selling food in LA right now is the hardest it's ever been.
Man.
And Smorgasburg is the center of that. Like, we can tell you that as much as anybody. I am not the kind of person who's going to sit here and be like, yo, we're fucking killing it, bro. You know, and people are like, oh, Smorgasburg is packed. The lines are so long. And it's like,
but you're not charging admission. So
it's like, listen, the lines, if you only come to Smorgasburg on like the big, like event days, the lines are long on those big days, but you come in between those days, like there are tons of vendors who don't have super long lines that are just as amazing as the vendors with the long lines.
Yeah.
And getting people to come, just like getting people to come to restaurants, even the viral restaurants. And I'm sure you've had this conversation with a lot of restaurateurs who people are like, oh yeah, you're blowing up, man. Like, you have lines. It's like, okay, talk to them a month from now. Right. Yeah. See, you know, cause there are certainly some restaurants, the most successful ones, that continue to have success and have built business models. But it's hard. It's hard to get people to keep coming back and to turn into an institution like a Casa Vega to last that long doing anything. And Smorgasburg, I feel like we're in the same boat. Like, you know, we're working just as hard to get people down as you know, every restaurant in the city.
The big advantage is that you do have such a variety of things, right? So you can have an excuse as a consumer. You have an excuse to go there. It's not like, oh, we keep doing the same thing. You're like, bro, there's 60 different places I want to try. So,
and we constantly have new places coming, but we also have every one of our vendors is there every single week until they decide to move on to graduate into a brick and mortar.
And that's like, talk about that for a sec, because you're big rain or shine or 120 degree.
Only because that's the restaurant business.
Yeah.
Like, we're open rain or shine. We force our vendors to be there to as much as we can.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we also care about them as people and we understand that, like, there's always emergencies, there's family emergencies, you know, but in the end, it's like, you know, nothing pisses me off, and I'm sure everybody off, more than showing up to a restaurant with your family to eat and it's closed.
Oh, God.
You see a sign that's like, oh, we're closed for Coachella. It's like, fuck you, man. Like, hire staff. Like, I don't care about, like, I'm coming here to eat. You're in my neighborhood. Like, I thought you'd be open.
Right.
Like, you know, and the best restaurants in the city, they never close. Like, you never show up to In-N-Out Burger and see a sign that's like, we're closed.
Correct.
Like, you, the way you build a successful restaurant is being open when you say you're going to be open, being able to build a staff, pay a staff, you know, those are, you know, and those are hard things to do. It is very difficult. And we're trying to help our vendors learn those lessons as hard as, and we know it's not easy, but we also know it is the key to being a successful business.
Right.
So we try our best to teach them those lessons with, you know, in a way that ultimately we hope ends up being a positive experience.
It's almost like a university experience, right? Where they get to learn, but there's a little bit of a safety net. There's some coaching, there's some teaching.
I mean, if you're into sports, some people call it like AAA. You know what
really?
I mean? Like, something like, a lot of sports fans have been like, oh, you're like the minor leagues, right? Like,
that's
where people,
kinda cool.
You know, and so many people have graduated from, you know, now I obviously am like, listen, I'm like, we're the fucking majors, dude.
Yeah.
Like, come on. But I get the point, right? Like,
well, you always have those, you know, those hyper talented prospects that are about to go to the big league. So the food, you know, could be big league caliber food, but like,
you're getting it before. Yeah,
it's dope.
And listen, everyone, all college basketball fans will be like, dude, college basketball is sometimes way more exciting and fun than the NBA, just for that reason. And that's Smorgasburg.
Because you got the fans, you have that true passion, the emotional connection. I want to go back and talk about the struggling restaurant industry. Again, something that can't be talked about enough. Especially in Los Angeles, I hear this all the time. Vendors that I've covered, that I've, you know, done reports on or just eaten at, rarely, nobody says they're killing it. Let's put it that way. I don't even know the last person I heard that's like, we're killing it, because that's just not the restaurant. Even if it's crowded, the cost of, you know, wages, food, lawsuits now, the lawsuit farms that are coming about employee, all this kind of stuff.
All of it.
There's so many bad elements to being in the restaurant business in Los Angeles. What is the payoff? How can somebody have that goal right now of doing, because there's so many tough, somebody texted me, I don't want to mention any names, but yesterday was like, you know, thank you for covering us.
Yeah.
We're hanging on by a string. And I was like, dude, what else can I do? He's like, no, it's not just me. It's everybody is hanging on by a string in this industry. We all need help. What is that like? How somebody getting in the restaurant industry, seeing their writing on the wall? I mean, what is
that
like?
I mean, the restaurant industry is affected by every other industry in LA and beyond.
Yeah.
Right. So rise in food costs affects restaurant industry. Hollywood going on strike affects the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
When you consider catering being such a huge part of how most restaurants survive, like, being open and serving food is not a great way to make money. It is hard. Like, and so it's funny. So I've told that a terrible idea story so many times that I feel like I'm ready to start a podcast that's called A Terrible Idea.
It's actually
because everybody in the restaurant industry knows that opening a restaurant, a hospitality business, selling food is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
And yet we continue to do it over and over again. Why? Why? Because we love serving food, love making food, love hospitality, love seeing smiles on people's faces. It doesn't make it a great business.
Right.
And like, it is not a good business, especially as real estate has become, you know, like, jeez,
like you said, it all ties together, you
know,
all of
and
them.
So it is all, you know, real estate, all of it. It all feeds into why the restaurant industry is in terrible shape. It's also supply and demand, you know, and as more and more people see restaurants as money-making opportunities, the harder it becomes for everybody to make money selling food. And the truth is, it never really at its core, it never really was about that, right? Like, especially, you know, as you look back through history, what restaurants were meant to be, who they were supposed to serve, you know, in neighborhoods and things like that. And so it's tough. It is, there are no easy answers. I always joke that I'd love to have a, I wish I could have a consulting company where people would pay me to tell them to just not open restaurants, because ultimately that would save them money in the long run, you know, but no one wants to pay to hear that advice,
right, you know?
And in the end, I do think it is incumbent on restaurants to, you know, do their best to create value for the consumer, right? And so I think that, listen, we all have a duty in this equation, the consumers, the restaurants, the people who run the restaurants, to sort of, you know, don't, if you're a restaurateur, don't spend a ton of money on rent. Like, try to find locations where you, you know, work hard to find ways to promote your restaurant that don't force you to charge an insane amount of money for your food.
Right.
And if you can't do that, then maybe you shouldn't be opening a restaurant, right? Unless you just love doing it. And the truth is that, you know, that's what I said when a vendor applies to Smorgasburg, we have honest conversations like this. And so
Being the gatekeeper, the aforementioned gatekeeper.
It's it's not like a lot of people think when they apply to Smorgasburg, it's like Shark Tank, you know, they show up to these tastings. They showed up to these tastings like, you know, I hope you like my food. And it's like, dude, you know, I'm going to love your food. Like, you're here for a reason. Like, I don't, you don't, if I sat, you know what good food tastes like, you know what I mean? But I tell people honestly how hard it is. And if they're not discouraged by that, then I know they at least have a chance to be successful at Smorgasburg. Because it is the people who show up and are like, I'm doing this to get rich. Like, I expect to sell 1,000.
Do people really say that?
Oh, yeah, of course. Because people don't understand. They see lines at Smorgasburg. And they'll show up and they'll serve me their burger. And I'll be like, okay, how many of these burgers do you need to sell every Sunday to be successful? And they're like, I don't know, 600. And I'm like, okay, let's talk about that. We're open 10 to 4. Yes, that's six hours. That's 100 burgers an hour. Are you going to sell 100 burgers? But I mean, 10 a.m., do a lot of people want to eat a burger at 10 a.m.?
Right.
Like, you know, can you – 100 burgers an hour is – 2 burgers a minute, not just making the burgers, but selling the burger, packaging the burger, taking the money, handing, and you watch their faces. You watch their faces like, oh, I never thought about any of this. Like, you know, and so now there are vendors who can do that.
Yeah.
They can sell 600, like Mia Mia Shawarma, our latest success story. Like, they are, have become popular enough that they can do an amount of sales that, when I first met them, I would have been like, listen, guys, a lot of things have to go right for you to get to this point. And you know what? A lot of things did go right for them. But it's impossible to know that when we accept a vendor, because you don't know how hard the person's going to work, how great their food is, how is it going to be perfect every single time? Like, and the best vendors, those are the ones who, you know, get it all right.
The fact that you're still seeing the success stories in times like this is pretty incredible. Because again, it's just, I hate that term gloom and doom, but that's really what you hear from almost anybody in that industry. Talk to me about food influencers, quote unquote, their impact on Smorgasburg.
I love them all. I love them all. They're amazing. Right, and they should, every one of them should come to Smorgasburg on Sunday and post about us, Evan.
But really it has, look, let's call it what it is. I mean, I see my wife, you know, TikTok when she's looking for somewhere to eat. It's just like, oh, this looks cool. That is how, you know, food journalism has certainly changed.
You're talking to a food blogger.
Yeah.
Like so when I launched my blog, Midtown Lunch, like, listen, I look back on some of the shit I wrote in 2006 and I'm like, this guy was an idiot. Like, he didn't know. And I can't even imagine what someone like Jonathan Gold or a real food critic like must have thought about my blog, you know, like writing about Midtown Lunches. I mean, it's embarrassing for me, right? Like, to think about it. So when I hear people go, oh, screw these influencers, they don't know what they're talking about. Like, I'm like, dude, I'm like, listen, they know enough about what they're talking about to want to be like, to have people. It's like a generational thing, right? Like, a lot of people don't want to be like talked down to, don't want to be, you know, and so every generation you have people who connect who connect
with.
And you know what? The longer you do it, the more you learn. You learn along with your audience. And so I will not sit here and talk shit about like influencers. Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, we can talk about it after you turn off the cameras. But the one difference I will say is if you want to talk shit about somebody, you should talk about the algorithm.
Here's something. I used to be, and I've never admitted this out loud. My wife knows this. I used to be a Yelp, like an avid.
I believe it's what's called a elite.
Yelp.
A Yelp elite.
Bro, I was so terrible. They never even accepted me into the Yelp elite program. And I was so offended. But I would write these reviews as if I was fucking Jonathan Gold. You know that tone? Like he was the second person. They always teach you about first person and third person. Jonathan Gold is the only person who wrote in second person. It was brilliant. It was beautiful. But you can't copy that, right? Where it's like, you're going to bite into this title, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I would like use that sort of tone. And then you mentioned like talking down to the audience. It's weird. There was a little like condescension inherent in being like a food critic or like early era blogger, which is really weird because people would not respond to that at all right now.
Yeah, but that's the thing is, and there are tons of people making content on social media that the algorithm doesn't respond to,
right?
That the audience, and so there are tons of people doing those kind of things on, so you know, and so listen, what I was going to say is the real thing, if you want to get mad at somebody, you should get rid of the, you should get mad at the algorithm, because in the end, at least with blogging, you could build up an audience who loved you and cared about you and followed you and would read your blog every day. And that was really valuable because that's the way people experience the internet. They would get to their office, they'd turn on their computer and they would just go to that blog the way they'd go to Midtown Lunch to find out where they were going to eat lunch that day, because that's the way people read the newspaper.
Yeah.
But now with social media, people don't do social media like that. And the accounts they follow don't necessarily get fed to them. And so the algorithm's more about being entertained by a steady flow of information. And so it is valuing a different kind of information than maybe. And so it is pushing content creators to create a certain kind of content.
Yeah.
And listen, my hope is that, listen, it's going to change at some point. The algorithm's going to change. There's going to be new technology. My hope is that we can get to a place where, you know, maybe the algorithm is influenced a little more by quality outcomes when it comes to food content.
Good luck.
But listen, in the end, there's no difference between what's going on now and what was happening with food bloggers. You're always going to have a new generation doing cool shit that people respond to, an older generation thumbing their nose and being like, these people are idiot, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I hate it just as much as everybody else hates it, but I also love it just as much as everybody else because I'm on my phone all the time. And I do discover new places and things. And, you know, and again, did I mention that influencers should come to Smorgasburg and post about us more? It's very hard because we're only on Sundays.
Yeah, but it makes it easier to focus on.
Getting you people to work on Sundays, really difficult, really difficult. Tell us
the 10-year anniversary plans. So 10-year, this
10
Sunday,
year,
June 21st. Tell us what's going down for the 10-year anniversary.
So Father's Day, we're really excited. So Smorgasburg going to be open just like normal, 10 to 4, completely free. All of our full-time vendors, but a number of them are going to be collabing with vendors from the first couple years.
Oh, really?
So we're working on a couple big things with some big names from our past, like Bub and Grandma's. A lot of people don't know that Bub and Grandma's started at Smorgasburg.
Big dog.
Bridgetown Roti.
Okay.
Who has an amazing Smorgasburg origin story. And then we have a few vendors who don't even exist anymore that are going to be coming back, some big names.
Can you say?
So a lot of people don't realize Holy Basil, which is my favorite Thai restaurant in LA. Now they have multiple locations, downtown, Santa Monica, Atwater Village. They actually started at Smorgasburg with a company called The Base. As a drink company, they used to make these iced tea and lemonade drinks that were served in these incredibly cool jars. Mm. Anybody who came to Smorgasburg those first couple years has one of these jars.
Yeah.
And you would bring it back every week and get like a refill for slightly less money.
Can you send me a picture of that so we can put that on that? Yeah.
And they're coming back to anniversary with commemorative jars. So kind of the old school real ones know. And if your jar broke or like you don't have the jar anymore, I'm pretty excited to like get another jar. Because if you look through our like our old Insta, it was like one of the earliest viral things.
Yeah.
And then the big one, the one I'm most excited about, is our most popular vendor ever whose food you cannot get anymore is coming back for Father's Day. Shrimp Daddy.
Really?
Was our Hawaiian garlic butter shrimp vendor they invented the whole like hollowed out pineapple. Like,
did they really invent that?
Well, they were the first ones to really do it.
Wow.
And then it got copied by a ton of other people. But the truth is that their food, their Hawaii, if you've had Hawaiian style garlic butter shrimp, their version's one of the best I've ever had. And it's incredible. And they ended up, they launched four different businesses at Smorgasburg.
Yeah.
And Shrimp Daddy was the most successful one. They also had a matcha business called Junbi, which they ended up growing into a franchise that now has 20 franchises across, including one location in Westwood. And Shrimp Daddy kind of fell by the wayside because they found it really difficult to make the food.
Interesting.
And so they couldn't figure out a way to do it. And we've actually partnered them with a company who has this technology that can help them make their food again in a, like, and make it as good as it was. And so they're going to be popping up at Smorgasburg.
Welcome back, Shrimp Daddy.
Yeah, it's which we'll be talking way more about on Instagram and in the, you know,
this
and stuff.
Week.
Yeah. It's I'm so excited to have Shrimpy. We've been doing R&D with this company. It's Next Robot. It's the company that helps. Have you been to Tiger Walk on Sawtelle?
No.
Amazing, amazing fast food Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
And so we've been working with that company to R&D the Shrimp Daddy recipe.
Yeah.
And it is as good as I've been eating so much of it. Oh my God. I can't wait for Father's Day eat it again.
That's legit. Let's do it. Okay. Before we wrap, I want to ask you outside of Smorgasburg, LA, I'm not going to ask you your five favorite tacos, your favorite pizza, but tell me like what an average week is like for you. And if you can explore LA, where are you going? What are the neighborhoods that you enjoy?
Everywhere. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
true.
You know.
And what's that hat, by the way? I've been looking at it all the time.
Oh, it's I love shawarma.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean,
got it. Yeah.
I'll go anywhere. I go everywhere. Right. I feel one of the great things about Culver City is it's pretty central.
Yeah, it is.
In fact, like I'd rather, sometimes it's easier to drive to SGV on the 10 than it is to go to like Brentwood or Santa Monica.
Jeez, dude.
For me anyway.
Dude.
Like I'll go anywhere. I still eat lunch like it's my job.
Yeah.
You know, like my Midtown lunch days.
Right.
But I spend a lot of time in all the places you'd imagine. Like SGV is huge. K-Town, the best. I'll go south to OC.
Wow.
Westminster, incredible. In between Anaheim and
Buena Park,
Buena Park. Yeah,
right.
I'll go anywhere for good food. Always looking.
Are you recruiting when you're out?
I mean, recruiting. We don't like to recruit because, listen, in the end, Smorgasburg's hard, and you got to want it. You got to want to be there. If you don't want to be there, it's not the place for you. So for me, I'm always hesitant to be like, you know, like to beg people to do it because I know how hard it's going to be and I don't want them to be pissed at me a month in.
Right.
Like, screw you, dude. Why did you convince me to do this? I'm still apologizing to people's parents, like Armin and Mini Kebab. Like, you know, like how many Sundays, like, you know, it takes people away from their kids, their parents.
Yikes.
Some people bring their parents.
Right.
Like we have this vendor, Teta, who does Lebanese food.
Yeah.
His mom works everywhere. And I'm like, I apologize to his mom. I'm like, I'm so sorry that your son is forcing you to make these Lebanese chicken wraps every single Sunday at Smorgasburg. So for us, it's like, you know, I'll casually drop hints to people like, listen, if you want to talk about being at Smorgasburg.
Yeah.
But in the end, for us, it's always, If you're interested in, if you're a small business, you make food, you know, you want to be at Smorgasburg, just fill out the application. Like, you know, it doesn't, and, you know, and we'll reach out and, you know, and if it's interesting to us, we'll set up a meeting, a tasting. And
how do people reach out? What's the best place to follow? What's the best place to stay up with Smorgasburg, you know, LA and Zach Brooks?
Yeah, at Smorgasburg LA on all the socials. I'm at Midtown Lunch LA. I've never gotten rid of the handle. Good. But, you know, if Instagram wants to reach out and give me at Zach Brooks, I'm ready for it. I'm here for it. And then our website is la.smorgasburg.com. And it has our, all the information about the event, information about all our vendors, and an application page that answers all your questions if you're a small food business and want to apply.
That's dope. So follow that, Smorgasburg LA. And last but not least, what does the future hold for Smorgasburg LA and Zach Brooks?
I don't know, man. My podcast, a terrible idea. You know, let's go, guys.
Get back.
No, I mean, I don't know, man. We're, you know, we're there every single Sunday. I'm super excited about the anniversary. But then the week after, we, you know, we're back on the grind. And then July, we launch our Ice Cream Alley, which is a big summertime thing.
That's dope.
Bring in a bunch of extra ice cream vendors.
Yeah.
Got our barbecue day at the end of August.
Oh, thank God. Okay. You know, I'll be there for barbecue day, by the way.
Yeah.
That's so my favorite. I feel LA is a little light on the great barbecue, which is crazy for a city like this that has everything. There's not enough great barbecue in LA.
Yeah. And I mean, Moose Craft Barbecue started at Smorgasburg. One of our biggest success stories.
Okay, like, there you go.
And so in the, you know, and so for us, it's always about getting out. Like, you come to Smorgasburg, I can tell you something good about every vendor. You don't have to look for who has the longest lines.
Yeah.
Every vendor does something interesting and good that's worth trying. And then the beauty is that you don't know who, but a few of those vendors are gonna be the next Moose, the next Mia Mia. And, you know, it's cool because even Mia Mia, the first 6-8 months they were open at Smorgasburg, they were busy, but you didn't have to wait. I mean, you waited 5 minutes, right? And, you know, now it's like 2-hour wait every time they pop up.
Really?
I was eating Mia Mia every week, like telling everyone who would listen, like, guys, like, this is, you know, it takes a while to get the social media coverage. And so coming to Smorgasburg is the best way to actually beat the lines before the vendors become famous.
And everybody, you know, wants to be, like, first, so you can be like, I remember back when.
Yeah, so.
Well, that is dope. Well, Zach Brooks, general manager of Smorgasburg LA, thank you for being here. Show up not just this Sunday, the 10-year anniversary, but every Sunday, 10 to 4 at the Row downtown LA, the longest running free outdoor, it's not even food fest, food market in Los Angeles. And it really is a great time. And one last note on the Row and the produce market, used to be the terminus of the Southern Pacific Railroad back when Los Angeles was the railway capital of the world. So a little more history for you out there. But Zach, thank you so much for being here.
I thought you were going to say free parking for 2 hours. Oh, I was going to laugh, and I was going to laugh.
Largest free parking in Los Angeles.
Dude, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it. Smorgasburg, LA. See you on Sunday. All right, LA. It's been a minute.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.